From our nation's capital, this is Naps Chat.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you.
Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of Naps Chat. I'm Bob Levy, the Director of Legislative and Political Affairs for the National Association of Postal Supervisors. During the past several weeks, Naps Chat listeners have benefited from the insight provided by the Postal Service's Office of Inspector General, whose mission is to promote integrity, accountability, and efficiency of the Postal Service. By fulfilling its mission, the Inspector General provides vital information to postal leadership, the U.S. Congress, and the American public. Moreover, the Office of Inspector General works to improve postal transparency. On July 22nd, the Office of Inspector General released the latest of its series of postal white papers. Its title is Options for Addressing the United States Postal Service Financial Gap. This recent white paper has received attention on Capitol Hill and within the Postal Service itself. With me today to discuss this latest analysis of postal finances is the primary author of the white paper, David Garcia, and he is joined by returning Naps Chat guest, Joyce Sanzone, who I believe is her third visit with us. David is a research analyst with the Office of Inspector General. He conducts research on topics that are of strategic importance to the Postal Service. Specifically, David has analyzed the Postal Service's price authority and best practices. Joy is also a research analyst at the Office of Inspector General. Her work is focused on postal trust funds, the retail network, and cost trends. I would be remiss if I did not acknowledge the consistent diligence of Tammy Hull, the third Inspector General of the Postal Service. She commands deep respect on Capitol Hill and among postal stakeholders for her stewardship of the Office of Inspector General and the work it conducts. But also, I appreciate her permitting Naps Chat access to David and Joy here today. Welcome to Naps Chat, David.
Thanks, Bob. Good to be with you.
Before we dive into the white paper, let's get down to basics. How does the Office of Inspector General function in terms of its relationship with the Postal Board of Governors and postal management?
So the OIG is the Postal Service's independent oversight agency. So we're an independent agency within the Postal Service that reports to Congress, and we're under the general supervision of 9 presidentially appointed governors. At the outset, you mentioned what our mission is, but again, it's just to promote the integrity, accountability, and efficiency of the Postal Service. And we do that in a few ways. We conduct investigations, we conduct audits, and we also do research. I'll just add that through this work, the OIG keeps the Postal Service governors, the PRC commissioners, and a range of other stakeholders like members of Congress and Postal Service management up to date on challenges and problems, and also on corrective actions.
With regard to the white paper, in introducing the analysis, the white paper observed that the Delivering for America plan failed to achieve its stated goal, that is ensuring financial stability of the Postal Service. As a result, the Inspector General describes 15 options that in combination, not independent, but in combination, could help the Postal Service narrow its financial gap. What is the goal of the white paper, and who requested it?
Yeah, so, the Postal Service is really at a critical junction right now, and probably I'll give you some stats that your listeners may be familiar with already, but mail volume is down 50% since it peaked in 2006. If you were to look only at first-class mail, which is the Postal Service's main profit vehicle, that number's down 57%. At the same time, as you probably know, the number of delivery points grows by well over 1 million every year. So what's happening is less mail is being delivered to more delivery points across the country. And then, of course, liquidity is a challenge for the Postal Service. The agency lost just about $9 billion last year, and things don't look great in the years ahead. So in about 5 years, the Postal Service's retiree health benefits fund is expected to be depleted. And once that happens, the agency will be on the hook for about $6 billion in additional costs every year. So really is at a critical juncture. Like you mentioned, what our paper does is compiles and evaluates 15 different revenue-generating and cost-saving options that could potentially improve the Postal Service's financial condition and help the agency close the financial gap. And really, the goal of the paper is to just draw attention to the Postal Service's financial challenges, but also to promote discussion among USPS stakeholders about possible pathways forward to restore the agency's long-term health.
These are possible options, not recommended options. Is that accurate?
It's extremely accurate. So these are 15 options that have been compiled by the OIG, but these are proposals that have been made by Postal Service stakeholders over time, and that includes members of Congress, think tanks, mailers and shippers, and even GAO. So actually what we did for this paper back in the winter is we started with a much longer list of options, again, proposals made by a range of stakeholders over time, and then we narrowed down that list to get to our core list of 15.
Let's talk about that narrowing down of the winnowing of the options. And you used three criteria for being included among the options, most of which would require legislation, others which are within the Postal Service's discretion but need regulatory approval or are subject to collective bargaining by the unions. Could you talk about the criteria that you used for the winnowing down process of the multitude of options that might be available? And also, has the Postal Service exhausted all the options it could self-initiate?
Yes, it's a good question. So we did start with a much larger list back in the winter. And to narrow it down to just the 15 that we focus on in the paper, we did apply three criteria. So we only selected options that we thought were very likely to generate additional revenue or cut costs if they were implemented. In a number of cases, there was the possibility of that happening, but we really focused on options where we were confident it would actually happen. We also selected options where the revenue gains or the cost savings could be estimated. So, we really did want to put a number to each of these 15 measures. So, in other words, if they were to be adopted, how much revenue could they generate or how much money could they help the Postal Service save? And then finally, we only chose options where the estimated revenue or cost savings was at least $500 million a year. And we wanted to put a floor on it, just given the magnitude of the Postal Service's financial losses. We really wanted to focus on options that could meaningfully put a dent into the financial gap.
The big ask that the Postmaster General has requested of Congress through legislation is to raise its debt limit from $15 billion to $34.5 billion. Is there any specific reason that was not included amongst the options?
That's right. So one way to improve the Postal Service's liquidity is for Congress to raise the debt limit. As you know, right now the Postal Service can borrow up to $15 billion total from the U.S. Department of the Treasury, and the agency has already hit that debt ceiling. It's worth noting that this limit has not changed in over 30 years, and it doesn't adjust for inflation. And like you said, the Postmaster General has advocated for that debt ceiling to be raised. We did not include the debt limit in our core list of 15 options because increasing it would not directly shrink the Postal Service's financial gap. Of course, it could provide the Postal Service with some liquidity to invest in its operations. And by investing in its operations, it could improve its efficiency and put itself in a better financial position. But we didn't think it would directly shrink the Postal Service's $9 billion annual loss. That said, I did mention earlier that we started with a much larger list of options that we narrowed down after applying those three criteria. We do actually talk a little bit about each of those additional options that didn't make our core list of 15 in one of the report's appendices. And we do actually talk about the debt limit in one of the appendices. We devote a couple paragraphs to it. It's certainly worth considering, but it didn't necessarily meet our three criteria for inclusion on that core list.
Two other options that were not included in your menu of options, and these were actually strategies that were suggested by the Inspector General in the past. And one of those is going into postal banking, which I know the IG's done work in postal banking, and co-location of federal services with post offices as a revenue-generating tool. How did they not make the threshold?
So it's a good question. Actually, indirectly, the co-location piece was included in our report. That was one of those tier two items that didn't necessarily meet our three criteria for inclusion in the core list of 15. But we actually did talk a little bit about government services in one of the appendices. And as you probably know, we recently released a report a month or two ago on how the Postal Service can expand its government services. And one of those government services that we talked about was co-location. So there may very well be an opportunity for the Postal Service to lease out some space in some of its post offices to government agencies, both at the federal, state, and local level. And, you know, if the Postal Service were to do this, and if state, local, and federal agencies were to take the Postal Service up on this, it could be a good way for the Postal Service to generate some additional revenue, but also for the state, local, and federal agencies to expand services in a cost-effective way. So we do devote a paragraph or so to that piece in one of the appendices.
In your paper, you talk about there's a continuum of different options from a maintain universal public service all the way to cutting service. So I'm just curious as to what weight you gave these specific options, recognizing the fact that the Postal Service as a government agency is tasked with providing public service.
That's right. So again, they're not OIG recommendations, and we're not endorsing any of the options. And so when we were selecting which options to include in the report, we didn't necessarily try to identify and include only options that helped advance the Postal Service's public service mission. That said, a number of the options that we do include in that list of 15 absolutely do that. So, for example, one of the options has the Postal Service receiving government funding for fulfilling the USO. In other words, the agency would receive some government funding to help offset the cost of providing the USO. And there are a couple other options that directly get at the agency's public service mission. But at the same time, there are other options that we talk about that are a lot more geared toward reducing the Postal Service's costs. So we also have an option that would have the Postal Service reduce some of the USO services that it provides to the country. There are some options that focus on the public service mission, while other options are geared much more heavily toward cost reduction.
Now, the Office of Inspector General has done a considerable amount of work in the past, as I recall, on looking at the Postal Service vis-a-vis foreign posts and how foreign posts have handled the universal service obligation. Now, I know you didn't discuss that in this report explicitly, but I'm just going to ask, the trend now, particularly in the European postal models, is contraction of what they deem to be a universal service obligation. Is there something to learn from that, or is that something to be wary of?
Well, one of the things that's interesting is a lot of posts that have pared back their USO, what they actually did is got a lot of public input before they did that to figure out what postal services are most important to their populations and to identify what they most need and want from their postal services. And they did this through public opinion surveys, through focus groups, and through wider consultations. So to the extent that there are lessons to be learned, really getting a good sense of what the public wants and needs from its postal service before big changes are made could be very, very useful.
Two other options that were raised in the paper, one of which Dave Williams, a former inspector general, proposed back probably around 2011, 2012, and that is the investment of trust funds into a more diverse package of options rather than be limited to treasury securities. Could you talk about the impact that that would have on postal finances if that were to be adopted?
Right. So right now, the Postal Service's retirement assets must be, by law, invested only in lower risk but also lower return Treasury securities. So one thing that the Postal Service could do, and the OIG released a couple white papers on this over the last few years.
Let me interrupt you. I know Joy and I talked about that in a previous podcast about those specific white papers, but now within the context of this white paper, I'm curious.
That's right. Yeah. So your listeners will have to go back to the NAPS chat archives to retrieve those podcasts with Joy. But yeah, so one option for the Postal Service, and our white paper talks a bit about this, is for those retirement assets to be diversified a bit. So not only invested in Treasury securities, but also potentially in stocks and bonds. And of course, over time, the stock and bond markets have outperformed returns that investors would get solely had they invested in Treasury securities. And actually, I think Joy's white paper found that had CSRS and FERS been invested in a diversified portfolio of 60% stocks, 40% bonds, going back decades, those funds would have had an additional $864 billion in combined assets. And of course, this could be very useful because it would have resulted in those funds being fully funded. As a result of that, there would have been no amortization expenses. And of course, the law also allows the Postal Service to transfer any CSRS fund surpluses into its Postal Service Retiree Health Benefits Fund, which could extend the lifespan of that fund.
As you pointed out, if these funds had been invested at the get-go, we would have this over $800 billion net asset. How long would it take right now, if we converted right now, as suggested in the white paper, to have a more diversified investment portfolio? About how long would it take to have a meaningful impact on postal finances?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we didn't quantify that in the paper, but it would depend on a couple of things. It obviously depends on the investment strategy, right? So, you know, that'll make a difference. And of course, it also depends on how the stock and bond market does. Obviously, if the stock market doubles in a year, you would get a much better return on investment than if the stock market was static or if it contracted. We didn't try to pinpoint the timeline, but depends on those two factors. And of course, it also takes time for investment returns to compound and accumulate over time.
The other option that was discussed was to recalculate the CSRS liability, and that is for employees who worked for the Postal Service before 1971. That is when the Postal Service was the Postal Department. And that was suggested, again, 2011 or thereabouts, by a report that was commissioned by the Postal Regulatory Commission, the so-called Siegel Report. That would have, if we were to adopt that, that would have a much shorter turnaround for having a meaningful impact on the Postal Service, would it not?
I think so. So this is another option that our paper talks about. And the OIG actually did a really good white paper on this. I think it was back in 2018. This one's maybe a little bit more complicated, but in 1971, like you said, when the old Post Office Department became the USPS as it is today, the CSRS costs for employees who worked at both the old Post Office Department and the new USPS were split up between USPS and the federal government. The Postal Service disputes the allocation methodology that was used to split up those CSRS costs. USPS believes that they have to foot a disproportionate share of those costs. And actually in 2018, the OIG estimated that the Postal Service's CSRS balance could be between $80 and $100 billion larger had an alternative allocation methodology been used than the one that actually was used.
These different methodologies are discretionary on the part of, let's say, the Office of Personnel Management or the Office of Management and Budget. They're not, it's sort of like you have different options. It's not they're violating some type of actuarial rule. It's just they chose an actuarial methodology that did not benefit the Postal Service, but benefited the federal government.
That's right. So it's up to OPM to determine which allocation methodology is used. And there was a Department of Justice memo I released not too long ago that noted that it would be up to Congress to direct OPM to use a different allocation methodology. But you're right, OPM is not violating any law or regulation. It's just the allocation methodology that they opted to use.
Another option that was proposed, or not proposed, that was listed, in the white paper is revisiting the Postal Reform Act of 2022's mandate for six-day mail delivery. That is really the only statutory definition of a universal service obligation we have right now. It's an explicit requirement that the Postal Service have an integrated mail network delivering 6 days a week. With everything we know, and I know you don't get into the politics, but with everything we know about congressional politics and how that legislation was enacted, how realistic do you believe it would be for Congress to go back from 6 day to 5 day or some other delivery frequency?
Yeah. So, Bob, of course, I wouldn't want to speak to what Congress might or might not do. But what the white paper that we just released does is presents that as an option, talks a little bit about what that option would entail. And it also covers some of the pros and cons of that option. So, of course, on the pro side, doing something like reducing delivery days could help the Postal Service reduce its processing, transportation, and labor costs. Obviously, that would be an upside. One of the potential negatives of it, however, is it could slow down delivery, right, if you reduce the number of days that mail is delivered. And, of course, what that could do is delay the delivery of some time-sensitive items like pharmaceuticals or financial statements or documents.
Another option raised in the paper is to revisit the limitation that postage increases cannot exceed the Consumer Price Index for urban consumers, CPIU. There were other methods of inflation one could use. What options are there?
Yeah, so as you know, back in 2006, price cap was put in place that prevented the Postal Service from raising rates on its market-dominant products above the rate of inflation. And like you said, the rate of inflation in this instance was measured by the CPIU. Of course, the CPIU is not the only measure of inflation out there. There are a number of others. And just to plug our prior work again, back in 2023, the OIG released a white paper that looked at what the Postal Service's rate authority and revenue for market-dominant products could have been had six alternative inflation indices been used in the price cap instead of the CPIU. And we actually found that some of those alternative inflation indices could have potentially allowed for more price authority, resulted in additional market-dominant revenue. And we also found that some of them tracked the Postal Service's costs a little bit more closely than the CPIU did. So, for example, one measure that we looked at, the Employment Cost Index, this is a price index that tracks the cost of labor over time. And we found that had the Employment Cost Index been used in the price cap, the Postal Service could have generated, on average, around $650 million more dollars a year in revenue between, I think it was 2011 and 2022. That said, I have to say that the point of that paper was not to identify the best inflation index to use or a better inflation index. It was only meant to look at the impact of alternative inflation indices.
Interesting, the Bureau of Labor Statistics has a delivery-specific inflation index, the CPI for delivery services, which excludes the postal. One version of it includes the Postal Service. Another version of it excludes the Postal Service and just does messenger services, FedEx, UPS. The other one is the Producer Price Index for delivery services. Are those options?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember back to that paper. So the CPIDS was certainly an outlier in that paper, like far and away the additional revenue and rate authority that could have been generated had the CPIDS been used. That drastically exceeded the CPI measure that's currently used in the price cap. The PPI was another measure that we looked at. I don't remember off the top of my head whether that would have generated more or less revenue or rate authority than the Consumer Price Index, but Yeah, PPI was another one we looked at. There's chain CPI, there's GDPPI, and a couple others.
Let me ask a last question for today, and I want to come back to something that you mentioned, and that is when we talk about the universal service obligation, when we talk about what the Postal Service is expected to do by the American public and by the mailing public in specific, you referred to surveys, focus groups, and so forth. Is it time that the United States or somebody out there do that in the United States?
It's important, and there's not right now a ton of recent data out there on what the American people most want and need from their postal service. So it would be good if that information were collected and then used by Postal Service stakeholders as they hopefully get together and talk about the pros and cons of different options and different pathways for the Postal Service to ultimately restore the agency's long-term financial health.
And something that the Inspector General has always talked about is the value of the Postal Service to the American public. And there's nothing that we would want to do, Congress or anyone out there, to devalue the Postal Service as we proceed with looking at particular options to help sustain it.
Yeah, it's well said.
Anyway, I want to thank David Garcia for joining us today and to be joined by Joy Sanzone and for on Naps Chat this week. And thank you for coming in.
Yeah, great to be with you, Bob. Thanks for having me. And just to let your listeners know where they can find the report, it's at uspsoig.gov.
Thanks so much for that, David. And I want to thank Naps Chat listeners for logging on. Please subscribe to Naps Chat on your preferred podcast platform and share Naps Chat with your friends and colleagues. In the meantime, stay safe, stay healthy.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you. I'm going